So I've not seen this argued anywhere. So, I mean, maybe I'm onto something here, or maybe I'm just talking complete bollocks, right?
We should just have that as a disclaimer at the start of the episode in general. Yeah.
This is our tagline. Bread and rosaries might be talking bollocks.
Welcome to Bread and Rosaries, a podcast about the UK, Christianity and the left. I'm Ben Molyneux-Hetherington, and I'm joined, as always, by Adam Spears. We're also joined by official wife of the podcast, Sarah Molyneux-Hetherington, returning for her second appearance. Sarah, what is it like to be a two-timer? Thank you both for laughing, but despite the fact that I used the exact same joke when we first tried to record this episode and it all went wrong at the end of season one, but you've still been prepared to laugh at my lame joke a second time.
To be honest, mate, I'd just completely forgotten everything that you said in that episode and every previous episode.
Mine definitely wasn't like an awkward, ha 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 ha, yeah, definitely not a two-timer joke. It was like a normal, ha ha, that's very funny and I love you and, you know, faithful to you, laugh.
Good. Reassured by that, I think.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, that's the sort of laugh it was.
Today we are talking about purity culture and how it looks in the UK. And as the official married couple of the podcast, talking to our single friend, we have to ask Adam, are you keeping it pure for the Lord?
I don't even know how you do that, to be honest.
I assume that you're in the same situation I was for many years, which is, officially speaking, you're keeping it pure for the Lord, but really it's just a lack of available offers.
Well, let's put it this way. I'm not wearing a silver ring.
So today's main topic is purity culture and what it looks like in the UK, which obviously begs a very clear question, which is, what is purity culture? So I have read recently the book Church 2, How Purity Culture Upholds Abuse and How to Find Healing by Emily Joy Allison, which is a really, really good book, and I'll be drawing some stuff from there as we go. And she defines purity culture in there in a way that I think is helpful. So purity culture is the spiritual colliery of rape culture created in Christian communities by theologies that teach complete sexual abstinence until legal monogamous marriage between a cisgender heterosexual man and a cisgender heterosexual woman for life or else. Purity culture is the culture created in our churches, schools, families, and parachurch organizations by these theologies. It doesn't have anything to do with delivery methods or what metaphors you use or how nicely you say it. If, at the end of the day, someone is still teaching that complete sexual abstinence until legal monogamous marriage between a cisgender heterosexual man and a cisgender heterosexual woman for life is a universal moral obligation or else, then guess what? They're still teaching purity culture. And I think that idea at the end is really, really important, because actually, once again, we're talking about something where there is a version of it in the UK that is just less outrageous and egregious in its presentation than it is in the States, but is still very much active in the UK. This is the theme that we keep coming back to, is that just because we say the stuff the Americans shout under our breath doesn't mean we don't still say it. And I think as well, there are things that we're going to talk about whereby purity culture might not even have to insist on heterosexuality to still be purity culture. But we will get onto that as well. So yeah, there's a couple of things that we want to note before we start. One is that purity culture and racism are really tightly entwined. There is a racial element to purity culture. We are not going to try and unpick that as three white people today. It is something that does need unpicking, but it is not something that we are qualified to talk about. Obviously, we might pick up on bits of it, but for the most part, assume that race is an underlying theme alongside what we're doing. So we're going to talk a little bit about purity culture, and I want to start by talking about modesty. Sarah, talk to me a bit about modesty. Do you dress modestly?
I don't even want to answer that question. I just don't. I just don't. What I will talk about is I'm going to just drop some like kernels of little flashes to the past of Sarah's upbringing, which I would say is fairly normal Christian upbringing. My parents very chill, really. But here's some little kernels. Growing up, and I'm sure the people listening to this who've had this exact same experience, there were certain rules about your clothing. Your straps of your top should be no less than 3 fingers wide, which I never got the strapping, the thinness of my straps, but there you go, that was one of them. Your skirt, if you had your hands down by your side, your skirt or shorts should not be shorter than your longest finger. My favourite, which was the hallelujah test, which is when you throw your hands in the air with a hallelujah, your top should not rise up and show your midriff. These were fairly standard kind of thrown around normal conversation thing. They weren't something that you necessarily got told off by anyone for, but they were assumptions. They were things that were in the conversation. And this is kind of going above and beyond, you know, having cleavage out or anything like that. This is just kind of even more innocuous about the things you're wearing.
It's really important to start with the acknowledgement that purity culture is rooted in misogyny, because this stuff, you know, all the rules you've just described are rules for women. Even that hallelujah test is the only one that could theoretically apply to traditional male clothing. And even that wasn't applied to men as far as I ever knew, really. I could get my belly out to my heart's content in church without it being an issue. But I think you hit on something important about it not being something that was actively taught, but something that was assumed. And I think that's really, really the crux of it, is that it is not that you are being told, oh, you must do this, you must do this, but that it's much subtler, that it's, oh, have you thought about, you know, what you're wearing, rather than you need to change your clothes, this is disgusting what you're wearing.
It's just in the culture, you know, it's just in the conversation when you're picking out outfits or what have you. It's also what you're judging other people's outfits on as well, trying to figure out for yourself what you wear. 1, 2, 3, 4!
Doesn't resonate because I'm not a woman, right? So I never experienced that directly, but I think that seems to be how it was in a lot of the churches that I attended. But I saw it a lot more directly taught at things like Soul Survivor. And yeah. I wonder whether you ever experienced that, some of the sessions that they do, like where they split up the boys and the girls, and whether they sort of explicitly said any of that.
Yeah, I mean, so side note, what was interesting about Soul Survivor is I was very briefly on the team doing like audio recording and stuff like that. And we had ran out of people. Someone was off sick and we ran out of people. And so we needed one of our girls to go record the boys' session. But the boys couldn't know there was a girl because we would inhibit their sharing. And so you had to put a hoodie on, have a hoodie or whatever. But it was really fascinating being part of both sessions and hearing both. But yes, there was conversation, particularly about stumbling blocks.
We know what that means, don't we? We all know what that means.
Yeah. I'm like,
they are particularly saggy if we're stumbling over them, to be fair.
I knew you were about to say that. I was about to make that joke. I'm really annoyed. Yeah, no, there was definitely stuff about not leading men into sin, not making it hard for your brothers in Christ, which I always thought was quite ironic, not making it hard for your brothers in Christ. in there. But, you know, there was a lot about that. And so, yeah, you heard it more overtly there. But I do think that while that was damaging, it was more about the way it was rehearsed in communities. And what it almost came to is these are the rules to keep you safe. If you follow all these rules, then when you are assaulted, you are innocent. You are blameless because you kept all the rules. But if you broke the rules, if you operated outside of them, then you'd kind of left the pack. And if something happened to you, to a certain extent, it was your fault. Or you at least were complicit in it. Or at the very least, you didn't have the support of your group around you because you had left the pack, you'd left the rules, you'd operated outside them.
Jesus weeps for Gaza. He sees the pain and suffering of the 1.9 million people who have been forced to leave their homes without access to nutritious food, clean water, decent shelter. He hears the cries of the 25,000 orphaned children. He is with all who mourn the 250 people killed every single day. Christians for Palestine UK is a group of Christians who are calling for an immediate ceasefire in Palestine. We don't pretend to have all the answers, but are united in our prayers, hope and action for equality, peace and justice for all the peoples of the Holy Land. Together, we are organising a Christian presence at the National Marches for Palestine and local Days of Action, where we've been joined by siblings from Sabil Kairos, Pax Christi, and a whole range of Christian churches. We urge you to join us to act in solidarity with the people of Palestine and call for a permanent ceasefire and just peace. The Very Reverend Canon Richard Sewell, Dean of St George's College in Jerusalem, says, "I warmly welcome the newly formed group, Christians for Palestine UK. Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank need to see the solidarity of Christians in the UK, and they will be encouraged to see your commitment to stand up for them in their time of terrible suffering." To find details of local actions, or to join the Christian bloc at a national march, follow Christians for Palestine UK on Instagram and Facebook, or email christiansforpalestineuk@gmail.com. Join us as we call for a ceasefire now.
And I think, you know, when Emily Jo Allison talks about purity culture being the Christian version of rape culture, I think that spells out really clearly, doesn't it? That kind of victim blaming, you know, that you see, you know, when a woman has been sexually assaulted, or what was she wearing? You know, this is just the Christian version of that packaged up in a Jesus-y bow.
Yeah, and I think it's probably also important to point out that even when it's not explicitly stated like that, it's implicitly felt. You know that people are sort of thinking things akin to that, or maybe they drop hints that that's what they actually mean.
I think that when I look back to like my youth group and whatever, and the girls who were kind of, again, this is all implied, but the girls that were kind of operating outside of those rules were not the ones being asked to do the course on biblical womanhood, or being the ones asked to lead the Bible study or what have you. They were seen as in some way of needing saving, of needing redemption a little bit more, that God hadn't completed God's saving work in their lives because the fruit, the evidence, is not being manifest. And of course, there were challenges for the boys. There were challenges for them, you know, ways that they had to perform to demonstrate grace and what have you. But there were just so many more for the girls. And then so many more on top of that if you don't identify as a boy or a girl.
Yeah, and I think that's really important, actually, is that there's a disciplining thing that goes on within these communities that isn't explicit. You know, it is not that you ever get told, oh, you're not being invited to, you know, be involved in the youth leading the service or to lead the Bible study or take some sort of youth leadership role because you dress like a whore. Like, that's never made explicit. It's just obvious, and everyone just knows, and there are little words and codes and ways of talking that kind of spell it out. But ultimately, if you keep wearing low-cut tops to church, or if you keep wearing, you know, shirts that are a little bit too short, or if you keep just being a little bit too flirty with the boys, then you aren't going to get invited to do the cool stuff. You aren't going to get up on stage. The best you can do is turn your life around and become an object lesson, right? Like, you are not, if you're behaving like that and if you're dressing in the wrong way or doing the wrong things, you are not getting the opportunities that other people are, even if that's never spelled out explicitly. And that really disciplines people into acting the right, in inverted commas, way.
It's kind of expected that you'll have your testimony come to Jesus moment. And of course, what all of this does It gives you so much to think about before you've left your house, because you don't want to be one of those frigid Christian girls, because you want to be a good ambassador for Christ in your school. And so therefore you want to look cool. You don't want to be a weird Christian. That would be a bad form of evangelism. But you also don't want to look too hot and too slutty so that your salt has lost its saltiness, so that you are, you know, undistinguishable from the other people. You don't want to lead people into sin, but you also don't want them to think you're weird. And like, as if being a teenager, you aren't filled up with enough insecurities and uncertainty about what to wear, and is it the right label or is it not, and all of this sort of, you've just piled a whole bunch more on at a stage where we're trying to figure out who we are and who we want to be. And it's a point where we're trying to figure out who we're attracted to and what sort of flirtation we enjoy, what you know, we're discovering our sexual self a lot of that time as well. And suddenly you've put all this anxiety in. So of course we can't bring down the patriarchy in our spare time, because we're focusing and working too much on trying to just get out of the bloody front door and deal with our own mental health issues that have been created and voices on us. You know, so we don't have time to fight about wage inequality. Like, I'm too busy having a panic attack about whether this top is cute or hot.
Maybe that's part of the point, though, as well. I mean, you know, let's face it, the majority of mainstream Christianity is pretty conservative, and they don't want you to fight for wage inequality.
It's intentional.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you've made it really clear this is a woman's thing, and there's something about women taking responsibility for men's lust, right? You know, men are visual creatures and women are emotional, and therefore women have to take responsibility for men's lust to the extent where, you know, when people quote unquote stumble and have, even if they don't have sex as you might think of it, have some sort of prohibited sexual contact, it's usually much more on the women than it is the men to be responsible for that. You know, for the blokes, they're almost a bit like, well, what were you meant to do? You know, if you get the opportunity, you know, self-control, all that stuff's hard. And, you know, that's kind of women as a temptress type stuff really plays into that as well.
So can I, I'm just going to give a slight trigger warning for sexual assault. If you need to not listen for 30 seconds a minute, then please do just tune out. But when I was growing up, there was numerous times of sexual assault and attempted rape. And every single time I was questioning what I had done. What had I done? What signals had I given? How had I... Because I'm a flirty person. I enjoy the attention. I'm not ashamed about that. That's just who I am. It's fun. So I was blaming myself because they were taking it too far, they were pushing it, they were all these sort of things. And because I believed it was my fault, I would put myself back in those same unsafe situations, but because I couldn't understand that the other person was the person that was unsafe. I thought I was the unsafe one because I'd been taught that I was the unsafe one. And so I was putting myself back in dangerous situations again and again. I couldn't get help. I couldn't tell anyone because I was filled with shame over what I had done, to the point where it took me years to realize it was not my fault. But the shame that fills you up from thinking it's your fault because you wore that thing or you did that thing or what have you is crippling. And a lot of people don't ever get that moment. Go on, think about it, and it's poisonous.
And I think that leads us on to talking a bit about abstinence, which is the idea that you shouldn't have sex before you're married. And I think, you know, what's really important about what you're saying, Sarah, is any breach of abstinence is a problem, even if that breach of abstinence was non-consensual. You know, sometimes people are better about it, you know, and people won't stand up front and say, you know, it's your fault if you were sexually assaulted. But at the same time, that's subtly communicated that you are lesser, that you have been ruined, spoilt somehow by your failure to be abstinent, even if it wasn't your choice. This is something that's been done to you, but you yourself are still valued less.
So the thing about abstinence is that not only do we not talk about sexual health and sexual education, we also don't talk about consent. We don't talk about no, yes, responses to that, enthusiastic yes. And by not talking about it, we create a culture in which it is easier to control and abuse people. When we, especially in the Christian context, we don't have a very strong no education. In fact, we're often taught the opposite. We're often taught to submit to your elders, submit to your parents, submit to your husband. We're taught to give everything to God, to not hold anything back or be struck down. We're taught to not hold anything back or be struck down. We're taught to give and give and God will give you what you need. We're taught to have a very unboundaried life, to put boundaries in place. And that, I think, reaches its peak, its zenith almost in an abstinence thing, which is kind of trying to tell you to say no to everything, but in a culture that often rejects the idea of saying no. It's kind of like you can say no, but not to us. You're not allowed to say no to us, the church, or no to me, your father, or no to me, your whatever. But you've got to say no in this one context. But of course, we don't teach people how to say no, because if we teach people how to say no more generally, they will have boundaries with us, the church, and that means it's a harder people to control.
Yeah, I think Emily Jo Allison puts it really well when she says purity culture doesn't actually teach young people to say no. It just teaches them to say nothing, because teaching them to say no, this is not the quote anymore, teaching them to say no is just a dangerous start towards being independent from the people who are in charge and you shouldn't be saying no to, which is church leaders.
Yeah, and the manipulation that this leaves you open to, I've seen this play out so many times with people in positions at least of like informal authority, where there are certainly questions about whether what's happening here, whether it be a relationship or whether it be a fling or whatever, is okay, and how much choice there was at either end in that.
Yeah, I mean, it leads on to loads. I mean, this is never ask someone to talk about their research because they won't stop, but part of my PhD is exploring spiritual abuse in the context of the Church of England, and so there's so many places that this can lead to. I really do feel like a lot of the absence stuff is saying no in that one specific situation, but never dare to say no in any other situation.
And of course, and actually with that modesty stuff you're talking about, it's actually, you don't need to say no if you're doing it right. You know, if you've dressed modestly, if you've behaved modestly, then you don't need to say no even in that situation. There's no need for it. So the things that are happening to you, well, you've brought them on yourself.
And this is perhaps reaches its most destructive and depressing when we see cases of sexual assault between church leaders and parishioners, where they have been taught, do not say no to the pastor, but do say no to sex. And they are caught in a conflict where they feel like it's completely their fault. Either they can, well, either they think it's completely their fault that they have somehow sullied a man of God, and it is often a man, but not exclusively.
But almost always, let's be honest. I'm sure there are examples, but I can't think of them off the top of my head.
No. And the second thing that can happen is to feel like this must be somehow good because a man of God did it. And then that sets you, and often it's the two together. And again, it's just the amount of toxicity and poison that comes from it. It's just utterly depressing.
So I want to talk a little bit about abstinence and what the definition of abstinence was when you were growing up. Because obviously it's quite hard to define, you know, sex is not actually one act. It's a spectrum of things. And there's all sorts of different definitions of what quote unquote full sex might look like in an abstinence context. So what I grew up with was don't touch anything you don't have on your own body, which was great for me because I had man boobs. But what did you guys grow up with? What were the rules? What was the official definition of abstinence, or was it left a bit fuzzy?
Yeah, it was a bit more fuzzy for me. I mean, I have to say, I think I went to an open evangelical C of E church. I was raised initially in a Baptist church, but I was very, very young when we mm-hmm. left. My experience growing up, the open evangelical like C of E church that I went to was more chill than you're going to find with a lot of these places. I think the difficulty is that there is crossover in like the kind of literature and the media that you're going to be getting alongside that as well. However, there were certainly times when maybe they got a speaker into the youth group who would be a bit more conservative than normally would be the case. So I think abstinence was kind of assumed, but it wasn't necessarily, unless something really bad happened, it wasn't that, you know, they were going to go and hunt you down and find out what everyone was doing. But in terms of what would be okay and what wouldn't be okay, I think the assumption would be basically don't be doing anything vaguely sexual with someone else.
But that wasn't taught explicitly. So for me, that was something that was taught explicitly. You know, these were the rules. And touching bums was the one that was the wiggle room. Some people said it was okay to touch bums. Other people said it wasn't.
Yeah, I mean, my church sort of changed a bit over the years. But I can certainly remember times in the earlier days where some of that was taught a little bit more explicitly. A big one that a lot of young people, young boys, I think in particular, really worry about is masturbation, right?
Yeah.
Partly because churches are either just, they just don't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't clarify. And so they end up thinking, well, what, you know, or they do talk about it and they end up just saying no.
Yeah, that was my experience. Masturbation was definitely
masturbation was your experience. All right.
Well, I mean, but what I was actually saying was that, yeah, in my church, it was explicitly said you should not be masturbating, only to the boys, obviously, because female masturbation and essentially female pleasure doesn't exist. So,
well, there we go. Glad we've cleared that one up.
So for me growing up, trying to think about how abstinence was taught. So my church went through quite a transformation, really. So my church growing up, it changed quite a bit, but it started when I was younger. It was kind of conservative, evangelical, quite God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Bible, kind of, and very focused on kind of historical, critical exegesis of scripture. But it also wasn't quite sure about what it then felt about women in leadership. So there was a bit of a kind of chivalry, per doll, per lamb. It's a man's job to look after the woman. That's where it kind of started. Then as it had a kind of charismatic revival, I guess, both in my church, but also kind of across the city, it changed again. And this is when you started to get in more like the rules for clothing, because it was therefore assumed that women had more agency as it was moving away from this very sexist place. Women suddenly had agency, which then actually meant women had responsibility and it was their fault. You know, neither were great places. But that's when the teaching, like what Ben just said, came in, which was if you don't have it, don't touch it. That was definitely something I learned as well. It started to be, you know, this kind of, if you don't have it, don't touch it. But then it kind of moved into somewhere like a little bit more, I don't know, malicious. The place where it moved to was that you can do it if you want, but you will regret it.
Yeah.
It moved into that more psychological. And that's where it came. And this is where the kind of I kiss dating goodbye phenomenon came through. If you don't know this book, it is. And I kind of feel for the guy. He was this kind of 18-year-old who was plucked out of nowhere and was given this big tour of all these Christian companies all over America, and who wrote this book about returning to courtship and kissing, dating, goodbye. And he, you know, he's later rescinded the book. He's kind of said, he's never apologized, which is why he's still a bit of a dick. But he has said, I don't stand by it now. But it started with this story, which haunted me. And there was a story that you wake up, it's your wedding day. And he's at the aisle and he's waiting and his bride is there and it's all beautiful, yada, 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 yada. The bride comes, yada, 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 yada. And they get to the point where they go, you know, would you say I do? And a woman stands up in the congregation and she walks over and she stands beside him. And his bride is looking at him, tears in her eyes, wondering what is going on. And slowly, you know, all these different women stand up and stand by him. And she is, you know, distraught, and he's distraught, his heart's broken, and she's saying, why, what is going on? And he goes, I want to give you my whole heart, but I also gave it to these people before, and I can only give you what's left. And that shit traumatized me. That terrified me, this idea that I was losing some part of myself every time. And that was in the context not of body, but of intimacy, of connection. That was giving your heart to someone, not giving your body to someone. And meanwhile, in our church, we were having this video played. If you ever want a sick, twisted 5 minutes, go to YouTube and Google sticky sex. It's not as...
Do not Google sticky sex. Yeah. I repeat, so, do not Google that.
It sounds really hot, to be honest. Like,
video, probably sticky sex, Christian absence or something like that. But it's a video of these plasticine people and they like jump together. And then when they come apart, there's bits of their plasticine on top of each other. And in the end, all these multicolored plasticine people end up being this kind of gross brown sludgy colour, which is also probably quite racist actually as well, but
probably.
But there was this concept that it said it moved from per doll she has to be protected to you have agency, therefore you have responsibility, here are these hard and fast rules, to you can do it but you're gonna regret it, you can do it but you're gonna be worse for it. You're going to be mucky. You're going to be dirty. You're going to not be able to give your whole heart to someone down the road. And in particular, I think the thing that was really disturbing was when it was about moments of intimacy and connection, quite apart from physical intimacy. It really cut you off.
I think you mentioning I Kissed Dating Goodbye by Joshua Harris is a really good way of thinking about how this functions in the UK. Because that did get imported to the UK. You know, people were reading, like Sarah, were reading I Kissed Dating Goodbye. But the kind of biblical courtship model that it espoused, it was not really something that ever happened in the UK. You know, I'm sure there are a few isolated cases of it. But by and large, even amongst quite conservative evangelicals, biblical courtship was a bit of a punchline. People still dated. They had boyfriends and girlfriends. And so, you know, it's almost like these ideas, they get imported and some of the more external, ridiculous stuff gets stripped away. You know, purity rings are relatively rare in the UK.
I had one.
Yeah, well, okay, we'll talk about that in a moment. But they're relatively rare in the UK. And especially now, they basically don't exist in the UK. You know, dads doing wedding ceremonies with their young daughters like you see in the States, that doesn't happen in the UK. Purity balls. Biblical worship, but the actual kernel of what it was teaching, that does get imported. You know, the ideas that were fundamental to this about sex, about your value as a human being, about women and men, all this stuff did get imported. It just didn't get imported in quite the same way. And I think that was, yeah, I think that was a really good example of how the really nasty stuff still exists. It's just not as blatant. Talk to us about purity rings.
Me?
Yeah.
I think I was so deeply confused. Okay, so it's helpful, again, a trigger warning for sexual assault and stuff like that. So I was, first of all, sexual assault, I was 10 years old, and it was a group of boys from my on my church youth weekend away who were kind of 15, 16. And so I was just so confused. You know, I was so confused, you know, right up till I was 19, 20 maybe, even then, about all these relationships were so painful. It was so rare. I was in a relationship that was actually healthy. In fact, most of them were unhealthy, if not abusive. And I was just so confused about what I was meant to do, what I was meant to be. I wasn't meant to be frigid, but I also wasn't meant to be, I don't know. I was hurting, and I didn't know how to deal with this. I didn't know where to go. I didn't know what to say. And that's one of the things about abstinence, is it just leaves you, this culture just leaves you marooned. If you fall foul of it, either through your own fault or through, you know, whatever circumstances, you are so alone. So I thought, well, maybe this is the answer. So I wandered the rink. I genuinely asked my dad to give his permission to everyone I dated. I said, I want you to vet them. He said no. If you ever meet my dad, podcast people, you will realise how ridiculous this request is. My dad was like, I don't want to get involved in that. There is no way of me winning at this. No, I'm not getting involved. Which, you know, fair. He was right. But I was fully bought into it because I thought that maybe might keep me safe. I was clinging on to anything that might keep me safe. I remember a friend's dad had, and it was a joke, but it's kind of like not as much of a joke as you might like. He had this like 2 double-sided page application to date my daughter pack that you could buy. And it asked questions like reference from your banker, references, you know, I know where that I have an axe in the house. And it was kind of a joke, but also kind of wasn't.
That's another, I think, classic way in which this stuff gets imported, is that it gets imported as a kind of joke, but not really. You know, again, we're not prepared to just say it with our whole chest. So we say it as a joke, but we say it in such a way that communicates that we're not really joking that much.
And this is how lost and hurt I was. I was dismayed my dad wasn't taking more of an active step in that, because I believe that's what you were meant to do to keep me safe. I think I was just desperate to be safe.
So it wouldn't be an episode of this podcast without us at least touching on politics and economics particularly. And as always, there's economics going on even when we're not aware of it. And purity culture is both a big business, but is also tied to the more broader running of the economy. So Adam, why don't you introduce us to some theory?
So I think it's really interesting to look at Max Weber's famous work, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, where he explains that modern capitalism has some of its roots in the Protestant Reformation and the kind of ways of thinking that came about because of that. So to give a very brief rundown of Weber's ideas, he points, first of all, to Martin Luther. And one of the things that Martin Luther does is that he says that work is an inherently good and holy thing. And not only that, but any work, being a farmer or a carpenter or whatever it is as good as being a monk or a nun or a priest, which straight away kind of changes how people have thought about this stuff over the centuries. And not necessarily in a bad way in and of itself, but it kind of sets the ball rolling. And one of the other things that Martin Luther does is that he emphasizes an individual relationship with God as opposed to a group membership, which had been how Christianity had been understood for a long, long time. It's part of the reason that you saw entire kingdoms converting. This is how it functioned for 1,000 years, really. When a missionary set out to convert a place, they didn't go around like people do today evangelizing individuals. They went to the top, they went to the king, and they converted the king, and then the nation converted en masse. That all changes with the Protestant Reformation, because Martin Luther says, no, it's not about group membership, it's about an individual relationship with God. So straight away, you've got workers' holiness and your individual relationship with God being really important. Then Calvin comes along and he pushes this thing called predestination, where God knows who is saved and who is not before time, and you don't. Nobody does. So what happens is that people start looking for signs that perhaps they are saved, you know, their names are in the book of life. And so, kind of paradoxically, your works become important again because they are signs of whether you're saved. And because of the importance of work in and of itself, there's a growing sense that success in business can be a sign that you are among the elect. And then you have Methodism comes along and says you have to have an orderly life, a plan, a method, right? That's where the name comes from. You need to be working towards your salvation. And so they say work, your life goals, your finances all have to be planned very carefully. And so things like saving, tithing, charity, all of these things are things that Methodists take quite seriously. Part of the reason I find it a little frustrating when people sort of equate Methodism with a British socialism is that, yeah, that is true, historically speaking, but it kind of bastardizes what socialism is because they fundamentally have this way of thinking at their core. And then you get a load of other people coming along. So like some Scottish Presbyterians in particular start saying, well, you also need to be really frugal with your money. You know, don't spend it on yourself, reinvest it into business and give to charity. And so all of these things kind of combine in people who work hard to be holy, try to prove their own salvation by being successful in business, plan everything, particularly their savings, and are frugal and reinvest their money in business. And so Max Weber says these things are fairly important for the founding, really, of modern capitalism. Now, if we look today, I think we can say that frugality has more or less been jettisoned in late-stage capitalism, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Nobody thinks that anymore. I mean, some of us do, but we're people who want to do away with the capitalist system, right?
I want to push back slightly on that and say that frugality is still a case for poor people.
Yeah, well, that's actually the thing is that is actually something that I want to come to, because a lot of these things are still the case for poor people. We pay lip service to frugality, to hard work, the idea that actually rich people are rich because they work hard and poor people are poor because they don't work hard enough or at all, which is obviously utterly ridiculous because poor people work many times harder than rich people and rich people get most of their money. I nearly said earn their money. That's not true. They get their money a lot of times through passive income.
Yeah,
and so fundamentally, you know, at its core, that's got nothing to do with hard work. And then, of course, even planning, it's a fairly tenuous relationship that rich people have with planning because, of course, our whole economy is founded on the basis of speculation. And it's like, yeah, there is a sense of planning there. You've got to think ahead about what you think the markets are going to do. But ultimately, it's all based kind of on gambling.
Yeah.
And so the kind of planning that we're going for here is very different to what one might think of when you think of planning. Either way, though, this is the history of Christian involvement in capitalism. And I think that we can see fairly clearly the thread of hyper-individualism, starting with Luther, but all the way through the Protestant Reformation and beyond. It's found its zenith in our culture today, the way we do capitalism today, right? Like the individual is the most important thing. So you've got that, but then individual purity is where you end up with this purity culture coming in. Both of those threads, individualism and purity, are obviously absolutely foundational aspects of purity culture. And I don't think that it is a coincidence that you see purity culture emerging out of some of the most capitalistic churches and pastors going, because they have these same ideas at their core, because that's their whole tradition. And what do they do with it? They start a whole movement where they sell their resources, their books. And to be honest, I wouldn't be surprised if they had shares in silver or something for their rings, you know. they probably do sell like these silver rings on their websites or something, right? So like they're making money off the back of this and then claiming that because they have all that money, their salvation is secure, that God is blessing them, and they are the model of what a Christian is to be. These things are all, in my opinion, absolutely interwoven with each other.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think you're right to point out that purity culture is big business as well. That there is money to be earned, book sales, preaching tours, and as you say, selling rings, selling resources, all this sort of nonsense. And even in the UK, there are people I can think of who have made their profile out of being the sex evangelicals, basically. The people whose thing is that they're telling it like it is about sex and sexuality and how it just happens to be an extremely conservative vision. And, you know, they set up organizations, they get paid to go in and deliver courses, they write books, they make money off this stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, another thing about this is that they are creating business for them. Purity culture is the sort of thing that is self-reinforcing. You create business for yourself by planting a seed in people's minds that nothing they ever do can be good enough. And so they're always worried and second-guessing themselves. So they're always just constantly going to be consuming these resources until they eventually figure out that it's all all bollocks.
And obviously we know that capitalism likes to sort people into family units for control and for marketing.
Yeah.
And so purity culture is just a more explicit form of that. It's a way of pressuring people into being into the sorts of units that capitalism likes people to be in.
Yeah, and I think as Christians, Jesus was not super down with the idea of family.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think like Matthew 12:46, he says, "Who are my mother and my brothers?"
Yeah.
And then widens the concept of family and turns all the disciples into his family. Don't get me wrong, it's a hard concept to put into practice because, you know, naturally we all are drawn, well, I was going to say we're all drawn to sort of our families and placing them.
But it's not, I think actually it's not that we're naturally all drawn. It's that we live in a society, Joker face, that forces us or, you know, polices our desires in such a way that we do end up feeling like the, you know, nuclear family is the natural thing to desire. But actually that desire is something that has been created and sustained within the culture that we live in.
I think that what we are is very communal animals, right? So like, it's not that the family in and of itself is a bad or even unnatural thing, whatever that means. It's just that we have taken something and basically twisted it to be the opposite of the very words that Jesus said.
Yeah, I guess I'm probably slightly more inclined to an abolition of the family approach. I can't say I've researched in any depth or, you know, particularly au fait with stuff about that, but I think there's something about actually recognising that certainly the way capitalism organises families is bad, particularly if we're thinking about, you know, child rearing and all that sort of thing. That should be something we should be looking to socialise, that actually communities should be raising children. That doesn't mean that there isn't a place for a particular special familial relationship, but there is, I think, a recognition that a lot of what we think of as natural desires around the family is something that has actually been created by pop culture, by just things like our taxation system. And I think purity culture is absolutely part of that process, by which a certain way of doing things is seen as the norm in a way that I just don't think is actually based in human reality.
Yeah, and the thing is, we sort of know that. We just don't quite get to the heart of it, because, I mean, we all know the old adage that it takes a whole village to raise a child. And if we're going to take that seriously, which I think we should, then really we need to be looking at what it is, not just to live in communities, but to live in community.
I think it's interesting because some Christians get mad about the fact that there's a declining marriage rate, but actually, particularly when you look at younger people, they're actually in more long-term committed relationships, more likely to be, you know, monogamous. They're actually having less sex, less drink, less drugs, all this sort of stuff. Because, as you know, we're living in this post-2008 financial crash world, and the financial net and the economic net is increasingly tightening around particularly younger people, it's cheaper to live in a couple and you're more likely to be able to afford to buy a house at some point as a couple than you are as an individual. So I think we are seeing actually that, for all the talk about how this is a decadent culture from some Christians that, you know, doesn't encourage marriage or relationships or whatever, actually we're seeing that the economic reality is one that does almost force people into relationships.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'd want to be careful with that as well, because we could end up with, you know, people making the argument that actually we should therefore make things more difficult for people. And actually what that ends up doing is forcing people into situations that they shouldn't be in, and things like abuse or whatever become a lot more likely in those situations.
But actually that's already happening, and obviously it's terrible, I totally agree with you, but, you know, I know people that haven't been able to leave abusive relationships because they would lose their healthcare, and because they would have to move out of where they're living, move somewhere else and drop to the bottom of a waiting list. So, you know, we're already in a situation where you are incentivized to stay in abusive relationships, particularly if you're not already wealthy.
Yeah. I mean, I come from a very working class family, right? And there are a lot of people living under that roof. I'm not going to say too much, but quite a lot of the time, because of the breakdown of a relationship, it's ended up where there aren't enough beds. And that is because things have got so economically difficult for people, where they're forced into these situations that just aren't tenable, really.
And actually, if you've got the choice between that and being in a relationship where things aren't good, but you get your own bed, you know, that is not always an easy decision to make.
It's not. It's not.
Adam, are you aware of the concept of Christian sex?
I mean, if you asked me what I thought that meant back then, it would be you save it for your wedding.
Oh,
right?
No, Adam, you are. So Christian sex is what the slightly more liberal, cool, hip with it Christians do.
Are you talking about the poop hole loophole?
I'm not talking about the poop hole loophole, although I kind of am.
Well, there's a loophole in the scripture that works really well, so I can get him off without going to hell. It's my Hail Mary, full of grace. In Jesus' name we go to fifth base. Oh, thank you for making me holy. And thank you for giving me holes to choose from. And since I'm not a godless whore, he'll have to come in the back door. Therefore, fuck me in the ass, cause I love Jesus. The good Lord would want it that way. Give me that sweet sensation of a throbbing rationalization. It's just between you and me. Cause everyone knows it's the sex that God can't see.
Christian sex is when you're not married, maybe you're engaged, maybe you're dating, who knows. And you're really, really horny for each other because it's like early days and you haven't been married and, you know, that all disappears. But like at this point...
Wow, revelations on this podcast.
Yeah.
You can tell we're 7 years now together. And yeah. Apparently Ben doesn't have an itch so much as a numbness.
But yeah, what you do is you have Christian sex, which is where you do not penetrate. The penis does not enter the vagina. But everything else is fine. Because that's the real sex.
I mean, that is the poop hole loophole, isn't it? That's what Sarah said.
No, so anal sex would also be penetration. Because you have to remember this is all quite queerphobic as well. Yeah, so anal sex. And obviously, you know, in this thing, actually queer women can't have sex with each other. They can only have Christian sex with each other. There needs to be a penis penetrating something for it to count as real sex.
Where do they stand on pegging then?
I honestly suspect they'd never considered it. We've known lots of people that did this would say that they were keeping sex for marriage, but were orgasming together a lot. And you think, well, sounds like you're probably having sex. And I think there's something really important about, you know, when we get to abstinence, because the definition of sex is quite fuzzy, you end up having to put in, just pick a point at which it officially counts as sex. I think we all were in places where, you know, the point was relatively low down on the spectrum. But actually, there are plenty of people for whom it doesn't count until the penis is inside something.
There have been some hilarious points that people have picked. Like, I've heard some crackers. One person can orgasm, but not two. If you do it at the same time, that's sex. You can accidentally orgasm if it just, you know, pop, then you didn't intend to. So you can go up until the point. You can dry hump all you want. I've heard some like crackers about like time of day or something. Have you guys ever heard the phrase theological acrobatics? It's that kind of concept, you know, where people are doing these kind of mental acrobatics to get what they want out of it.
Yeah.
But I heard some brilliant ones. And then there was also along with that, the sense that people didn't actually know what can make you pregnant and what can't. So people who were like, I'm pregnant, but I haven't had sex. And I'm like, well, let's talk about that.
Yeah.
I mean, there is precedent for that, to be fair.
There's something really important here about how central marriage is as a concept. And so all these people, you know, they have to keep marriage as something special, but also they kind of just want to shag. Because, you know, if you've been with someone a year, when we're talking about how our bodies work, your body is just screaming shag, 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 shag at you if you've not had sex and you've been in a committed relationship with someone for that long. And obviously, obviously asexual people exist, and there are people who make decisions for, you know, their own reasons to refrain from certain sexual activity, and that's their choice. But I think for the majority of people, it is about, yeah, bending over backwards to try and make all this work. And I think it does come back to actually how important marriage was in these contexts. You know, it's pretty rare to see unmarried people in leadership. It's worth of comment. Maybe not so much in kind of smaller local churches, but in terms of national organizations or large churches, you got to be married. And, you know, I think marriage was presented as almost the end point of your, you know, your teenage years, and even your, you know, early 20s to an extent, were meant to culminate in a wedding. That was where the journey was heading. That was the ultimate point.
Because you're going to lock that shit down.
Yeah.
Because, you know, especially women as well, I think, there's like a dangerousness to, you know, they're loose, they're out there, their sexual drive. And
I think as well, the really important thing is how that manifests. So the churches that take this to the nth degree, I guess, end up with multiple broken marriages and people just in pain because they celebrate marriage and denigrate sex outside of marriage so much that these young people feel pressured into marrying. Like, I mean, I've seen people marry at like 17 and like a few years later, like the whole thing's fallen apart. It's a mess. And it's really damaging because it destroys, obviously it destroys the relationship between these two people, but it, you know, it destroys a lot of things around them as well. And they end up getting judged for it. And you just see it all over the place.
I mean, I always think about the fact that like we got married, we were both 24 when we got married, and we got married as one of the latest of our Christian friends to get married, and the earliest amongst our, you know, heathen. Not Christian heathen friends. You know, it was so different. Like,
can I just say, I'm now 32 and unmarried, and I'm pretty sure I'm a Christian, so I'm not sure where I fit into this. So am I just not your friend?
We just never think you're getting married.
I see us more as podcast colleagues, but like, you know, actually, the majority of our, and you have to remember, of course, that we've both been evangelical churches, CUs, all this sort of.
You went to literal Bible college.
Yeah, I was at a Bible college. So, you know, the majority of our Christian friends were evangelicals and to varying degrees conservative. But, like, you know, we did, you know, at 24, we were, you know, friends of ours that weren't Christians were like, wow, you guys are getting married young. And friends of ours that were Christians were like, yeah, this is like the normal marrying age, if not a little bit late. And I do think that really speaks volumes. And, you know, I just think marriage is such a central idea. And I think there's something as well, you know, we said we'd touch on some of the racism aspect of it, but we need to be having white Christian babies because, you know, the Muslims are coming over and having babies and taking over the country. So I think there's definitely an element of that at play there as well. But I just think it's also this, you know, just base assumption that it's almost like your real life starts when you get married. You know, you're not going to achieve anything while you're single. So get wifed up and then get things going.
One thing we haven't talked about yet about purity culture is one thing actually most people talk about first. So don't know what that says about us. But the concept that your purity, your innocence, all that sort of thing is present in you up until the point of penetration, that if you as a woman, particularly as a woman, I'm speaking from a female perspective, if you have sex, then you are suddenly dirty, you're impure, you're all that sort of stuff, unless you're married. And of course, all that programming, all that thinking, that does not just disappear in an hour wedding service. You have an hour wedding service, you have the breakfast, you have the party, you go up to your bedroom, and suddenly it's okay. That morning, if you started that morning by having sex, impure. That night, totally fine. And of course, it doesn't work like that. There are so many people for whom there is such psychological trauma because they do have sex and they feel impure, they feel dirty, they feel less than, they feel all of those things. For other people, they don't have sex with their husband or wife for a while because they just can't shake the feeling that it'll suddenly be okay. A lot of people experience sexual difficulties, find it really hard to get turned on because guess what? They've not learned what turns them on. they've not learned to enjoy foreplay. And so they don't know all these things. But also for guys, I think guys are sometimes, and we've talked, there's a lot of podcasts and books that talked about it from a female perspective. And I'm really glad because it really needs to be spoken about. There's so many people struggling with that. But also I think guys are taught to, that they are dangerous. They have between their legs something that can make that person impure, that can render them dirty, poisoned, bad goods, damaged goods, whatever. They've got a very literal weapon here at their disposal. And some of those guys who really have internalized that message, we talk about guys don't get quite the same message, but for some they have and they've internalized it, they will find it very hard to then have sex with their wife because they've been taught that they're going to damage her. You know, I remember I was ministering to a couple who said that the first 10 years of their marriage was effectively quite a lot of marital rape because they just didn't understand what submitting to one another, different desires, different kind of what gets people in the mood, foreplay, all that sort of stuff. So for the first 10 years of their marriage, there had been repeated incidences of marital rape that they're now trying to push through in their relationship. They're trying to work. They're both deeply sorry about what happened.
Group years ago where they got someone like a recently married young-ish couple in to talk, and they had their baby with them, so like they had obviously, like, you know it happens, like you conceive like immediately. So I just remembered this story that the guy told. They told us what happened on their wedding night. They just went through it in some detail,
which is what we're gonna do now. So we went into the room and Sarah took her wedding dress off, and then we both fell asleep immediately because weddings are fucking tiring.
That's fair. And I
fell asleep, passed out from the alcohol.
One or the other, yeah. But there was also, you know, like there were people that assumed that we were having sex for the first time our wedding night, despite the fact we'd been living together for a year in a shared bed. Like, we weren't in separate bedrooms. And it's like, yeah, we've been going to sleep every night with a line of pillows between us. Like, what are you, it's so ingrained that it wasn't that people were like, oh yeah, they'll definitely, they just assumed, are they getting married? They must therefore be having sex for the first time.
We had some lovely, lovely friends, very misguided, who, in the card, sent us a text and on the advice slips made it very clear that pain is to be expected, that pain is normal.
Have they not heard of lube?
Yeah. Do you know what? Unbelievably, I was like, let's ignore them. Sarah sent a text essentially explaining the concept of lube to them.
Okay, so what they said, so not only that pain, you know, it could, so they didn't know. No one explained to them, but pain is normal and it could go on for 6 months, a year. And I was like, no. It can be clumsy. It can be a little bit embarrassing the first time you have sex with somebody. It can not go quite right. All of those things. You should be able to laugh at it, but you should not be experiencing pain. That is totally wrong. If anyone has ever told you pain is normal, fuck that person, okay? It should not be painful. It can be embarrassing at times or what have you.
And like, there can be times where there was a small amount of pain that's like part of things, or
you pulled a muscle.
Or, you know, decisions have been made and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, if you want pain. But they were doing us a solid in their mind view because they had been experiencing this alone and that no one was talking about it. And it takes courage, really, to share that. That was a really kind gesture in their worldview. So I remember I sent them a message because I was like, well, you are my friends and you've been open and vulnerable with me. I'm going to be open and vulnerable with you. And said, you know, actually, it shouldn't be painful. Anne Summers does a very discreet delivery service. There's no packaging that says Anne Summers, all that sort of stuff. Other retailers are also available. But, you know,
you're buying Tesco's, for fuck's sake.
Tesco, every little helps.
There's a lot of stuff we need to do differently about sex education. I think particularly in churches and particularly in sort of conservative, certainly conservative evangelical churches, the focus is so on purity, it's so on abstinence that no concept of consent is really taught. But second of all, as you were sort of saying earlier, you just end up with people who just don't know what they're doing. And I sort of ended up getting sidetracked from this, but finish very quickly the story I was telling earlier. They brought this couple into the youth group and they explained to us that on their wedding night, they didn't have sex, not because they were super tired like you guys, but because they didn't know what to do. They tried to do it and he didn't know where to put his penis and she didn't, like, they had no idea. And they had to take a day to go and like read up on it to find out because they were just never taught. You know, I've known people who have been educated at independent Christian schools as well. And I think that's definitely more the case there too.
At your age, you're going to be having a lot of urges. You're going to want to take off your clothes and touch each other. But if you do touch each other, you will get chlamydia and die.
I never had sex ed. I was in a Christian secondary. And I think there was, I wasn't in school or something. You know, whatever, however it happened, I went through school without any sex ed. You know, it does happen. So go on, you freaky little people. Figure out what you enjoy. What Bread and Roses is telling you is go get some ethical porn and figure out what you like before you have sex.
This woman does not speak for the Bread and Roses podcast.
Yeah, I think I want to sort of be very clear that we speak as individuals.
Hey, I said ethical. Pay for your porn. Buy it from feminist directors. Buy it from women. And figure out what you like.
And you know what? If that is your position on this, Sarah, that is great. You do.
I actually charged it as an expense for.
So one final thing I wanted to touch on a little bit was what, for lack of a better term, I want to kind of call queer inclusive purity culture, which is where they kind of say, actually, it's okay, you know, some people are gay, sometimes it's trans inclusive, I think a lot of the time it's probably not, and they probably don't even know about the existence of non-binary people. But in terms of men with men and women with women, they'll say, yeah, that's fine, you just have to obey the same rules. And I think, you know, even in the UK, that's not like a big thing, but I've seen places where this is what is being taught. It's a form of purity culture that is broadly queer, or it's probably better to say gay and lesbian inclusive. And I think that's something that's really fascinating. And obviously there's something about the way in which queerness is trying to be homogenized into looking exactly like straight relationships, only with different genders involved.
I mean, I know my church community grew up in was scared of the queer community, was as condemning as it could be, really. Somewhat infamously, the Bishop of Carlisle blamed the floods on acceptance of queer people. In Carlisle, where it was not safe to be queer, take it from me. The supposed promiscuity within the gay culture was like taken as yet another piece of evidence that it was not of God. So there was definitely this kind of complication between purity culture and homophobia, where they were kind of feeding into each other. They were sort of proving each other's points. And so there is a kind of imperialism colonization going on that is saying, if you can behave how we believe straight couples should behave, then okay, you can come into the party. Without even learning or accepting some of the joy and beauty within the queer culture has so much to teach the church about consent, about communication, about standing and speaking truth to power. And the church is not really accepting queer culture, it's accepting people who are queer as long as it can follow its rules. And it's reducing the whole of queer culture to you have a penis and you have a penis and you guys go to bed. And that is such the lowest reading of queer culture, which celebrates polyamory, it celebrates pansexuality, it celebrates asexuality, it celebrates a whole range of things and is very anti-patriarchal. So yeah, there's definitely a kind of play by our rules and we'll overlook the fact that you're not Adam and Eve.
Yeah, and I think obviously there needs to be a re-evaluation in a sense from Christians about what marriage is, where it comes from. Because I mean, like, I am positive about marriage. I think marriage is a good thing.
Yeah, because you've not been fucking married.
I mean, I live in hope, Ben.
That was really bitter, Ben. That was a real bitter moment.
This is a podcast, not a therapy session. Move on, Adam.
Do we need to talk about this, Ben?
It was bitter to everyone as well.
there was a lot of like pent up rage there, like an impotent rage.
Shock! A white man with impotent rage.
Like, I feel like, yeah, some therapy might be a good idea, darling.
I already pay hand over fist for that. Moving onwards, Adam.
Yeah, you know, Christians need to look at marriage and work out where it's come from, what it is, and what we want to do with it. You know, for obvious reasons that we've already discussed. But the other thing is to kind of push back on that a little bit, I guess. There are a lot of churches that are obviously just nowhere near that. That's just not going to happen for a long, long time. And there's a sense in which I almost kind of want to affirm some of the more conservative approaches, like, you know, the Matthew Vines book, God and a Gay Christian. He is pretty conservative. He's an evangelical and he takes that approach that he, I guess, would call traditional marriage. Now, I don't necessarily agree with what he's saying. I think there are some things in there that might be damaging in certain contexts. But I think we also need to realize that this is the first step that some churches can take in that direction. Yeah. There are issues with it, but I also don't want to like be too down on it because otherwise we're just going to end up with nothing at all.
I get that. I just don't want people to expect me to be fucking grateful for it. And that's what sometimes happens is like, you should be grateful for it. I'm like, I'm a gay, female, disabled Christian. I am sick of paying by people's rules. Rules that are not there to prosper me, to help me thrive. Rules that are meant to make me smaller and less difficult. And so I get that it's a process and I get that that is a good step. But what happens is people kind of rest in their laurels and expect me to be grateful for it. And then they're like, but why are you angry? And I'm like, why am I angry? Like, live a day, you'll figure out why I'm angry. Yeah, I'm now tapping into my pent-up rage and anger about this, which just says, that's great. I'm really glad that you're beginning on a journey to inclusivity. I get that it's baby steps, and that's great. Just don't expect me to not be angry, and definitely don't expect me to be grateful.
I think the other thing as well with that is, it's good that we have equal marriage in this country. But for the most part, most people in the LGBTQ plus community weren't actually pushing for marriage. A lot of them see it as just a fundamentally patriarchal and damaging institution. And we have to be very, very careful to make sure that we're aware of the political background to pushes for equal marriage. So like in the UK, the reason we got it was because David Cameron thought it would be a vote winner. And it was.
Yeah.
It should give you pause to thought that a Conservative Prime Minister was the one who pushed through equal marriage.
Yeah, and even then he got a lot of pushback from his own party.
And we slipped down the rankings again. There was, for a very brief point, we were voted one of the most LGBTQ inclusive communities in Europe. And now we're nowhere near the top now. It was tokenistic.
Well, that could be because we're trying to murder as many trans people as possible right now. So
yeah, that would be it.
Another day on Turf Island.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that will do us for the podcast today. Sarah, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, guys. It's always a thing that I do with you guys.
That is the nicest thing we're probably getting out of you there, to be fair. As always, you can find us on your podcast feeds. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/breadandrosaries, on Twitter at bread_rosaries, and you can email us breadandrosaries@gmail.com. Adam, where in the world can people find you?
You can find me in most places at @commiexian.
And we will see you next time out. Thank you very much, everyone. Yeah, we've read them out on the show before, which if you'd ever listened, you'd know that.
Yeah, we have had an email, yeah.
Don't just say Anne, then it makes it clear how many we've had. We've actually had more than one, but we've only read one out.
Scams, though, are they all like...
No. People email us to talk to us.
Who are these people?
Fans of the show.
Yeah.
Is it your mum?
Ignore Sarah. No, mum doesn't listen to this, thank God.